Or good afternoon, or good morning, depending on where it is that you are located. Thank you so much for joining us here for this live CDN webinar with Dr. Benny Pizer, who has been the director of the Global Warming Policy Foundation since it was established, I gather, on the floor of the House of Lords in 2009. Not many of us can say that about one of our ventures. Thank you very much for being here today with us.
Thanks for having me, John.
And it is particularly since you've just stepped down from the job of director after more than a decade and a half, I wanted to start with a general question about how, in your view, has the discussion, debate, bickering, whatever we've been having about global warming or say climate change, nay, global warming, how has it developed since 2009?
How has it developed? Well, I think the last couple of years are different to the first 13 years of our existence, or perhaps the first 20 years of the whole climate movement, in that the whole agenda is now falling apart. We knew that was going to happen at some point. I didn't anticipate to happen that rapidly. But it is now quite obvious that it's falling apart. The first, I would say, 2 decades or perhaps even 3 decades of the global warming hysteria were an upward trajectory, almost, you know, unstoppable. First, a Western apocalyptic movement, then almost kind of changing to an almost global movement. Everyone was caught up, not everyone, but a lot of people were caught up in it. The media obviously played a large role in that. They connived with the climate alarmists and hyped up every storm, every heavy rainfall. So it looked as if this was going to accelerate without any end in sight. And only in the last couple of years, the wheels have come off and it's now disintegrating in front of our noses.
And when you say it's disintegrating, I'm guessing that the primary problem here is that the alarmists have been challenged to implement their program. They haven't been prevented from implementing it. They've been told you control the levers of government in practically every country, certainly in Canada and in the UK, but they've been unable to do the things they said were easy.
Well, because the whole edifice is a utopian eco-socialist agenda. It was wishful thinking from the start. If people were rationalists and were serious about decarbonization, they would have never touched any renewables. They would have gone for gas and nuclear energy, and they might have decarbonized even more than today. Renewables is a complete house of cards that is now falling apart. And while you're right, the reason why we're in such a mess, primarily in the Western world, is that the apocalyptic eco-socialist academic world has completely dominated research, and the universities have essentially eradicated any opposition or skeptical voices from universities, from journals, from scientific institutions, and so on. So it's a bit like the Soviet Union, where there was only one voice and one opinion accepted. And that's the reason why we are in the mess we are. But because the policies are now biting people and hurting them in the pocket, there is this growing opposition, and governments, you know, left, right, and center are rowing back, watering down, and reneging on a lot of these policies because they can't afford them. the public is increasingly against them, and much of the competition in the rest of the world is just freeloading and enjoying the West's self-destruction.
Yeah, it really is a multifaceted disaster. And in fact, just this morning, I noticed a news story that Britain's last steelmaker was closing. And the backstory to this is that this steelmaker is actually owned from China. And the British government was trying to give them enough subsidies to keep the plant open. And they were unable to come up with enough money to make this not an idiotic proposition. And this is just at the moment that Britain's thinking it needs to take more responsibility for its own security, partly because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and partly because the United States seems to be withdrawing into isolation. And so this is just one of a huge number of ways in which the green agenda, pushing up energy prices, discouraging manufacturing, has crashed into other less frivolous government responsibilities in a way that reveals that they, among other things, they hadn't thought this through.
Oh, they never thought this through. It is pure kind of, it's ironic, or you can call it tragic repeat of the socialist experiment that went so terribly wrong. It's kind of command and control economics, whereby the government decides what you're allowed to do, what you're allowed to produce, what you're allowed to buy, how often you're allowed to do certain things, or how to heat your home, and with what technology. It's, you know, if you think about it, it's complete, utter madness. But that's what happens if there is no second opinion, if there is no one to say, hold on, let's think this through. And this hasn't happened. This was intentionally eradicated through cancel culture and sacking of skeptical scientists and silencing any second opinion. And so we're in this cul-de-sac and have now to get out of the deep hole that Western nations have dug for themselves.
And there you highlight one of the odd things about climate alarmism, because if you take as a proposition, human beings are affecting the ecosystem primarily through production of CO2 in ways that are making the temperature rise and the weather deteriorate. There's nothing in that proposition that would lead you to say we mustn't have free debate or we mustn't have nuclear power. And at the Climate Discussion Nexus, we've said on a number of occasions that support for nuclear power is something of a sanity test for climate alarmists. That if you really believe what you say you believe about the processes whereby fossil fuels are causing all this damage, but you don't want us all to freeze in the dark, you have to be in favor of nuclear reactors. And yet, even now, it's a very rare alarmist in power or out who is a wholehearted supporter of nuclear. And that's one of those red flags about the way that they think.
Well, it has never been about the climate, let's face it. Most people don't understand the climate. Most scientists don't understand the climate. All they hear is that it's the end of the world, that we have to save the planet, that we only have 10 years to save the planet. And it goes without saying, apocalyptic movements throughout history cannot stomach a second opinion, cannot stomach discussion or debates. And that is a typical feature of the kind of doomsday apocalyptic movements throughout history. So if it were about the climate, if it were about global warming, as I said, there would have been cheaper, better, and technologically sustainable forms of decarbonization. They were never on the table because the alarmists have their own agenda, and it is not climate. It is big government, command and control, shutting down anyone who questions the kind of conventional wisdom. And it is, as I said, a repeat of socialism in, you know, green colors. I've seen it. It's essentially started with the same people. When the Berlin Wall fell and the Marxists were basically, you know, at their end and realized that Marxism was no longer feasible, they just colored it green and essentially promoted the same kind of big government command and control economics than before, but, you know, in the name of the climate, which they have no idea about, and most people don't have. It's a highly complex issue. We know it's warming, but we don't know whether it will be a problem in the future. It currently isn't a problem, but it may be a problem in the future, but who knows?
Yeah, and it's an interesting way into the discussion, because I remember when climate alarmism rather suddenly became the crise du jour here in Canada, I was working on the Ottawa Citizen editorial board at the time. And I remember our prime minister, Jean Chrétien, was suddenly talking about climate deniers. And this set off a number of alarm bells for me, because I'm a historian by training. And every now and again, I get heckled by people saying, oh, you're a historian, man. What do you know about climate? To which my answer is, well, historians are people who are trained to look at the past to try to understand the present. And I don't really understand what other way we would have of doing it. But when I heard the rhetoric coming out of the prime minister and others, I thought, I've heard this before. This is a familiar way of arguing, denigrating opponents, trying to shut down debate, insisting that there's a consensus and that there's no time to talk about it. And I'm going to give them credit for a little more sincerity, I think, because these are people who've always had this gut feeling that they must seize control in this crisis, that ordinary people cannot be left to their own devices. And so one thing or another will come up and they'll go, oh, that's why we have to do it. But I think they really do believe it. I think Al Gore really believes he needs to be in charge. And I think Al Gore really believes that human beings are overheating the climate. I don't think he's pretending on that score. But he's not, doesn't mean he's thinking very rationally about it.
Well, they believed socialism was the better way of doing things and was the more successful economy, and it was fairer and it was more social and more economic. And, you know, they also believed, I mean, they were the worst. The true believers were the worst, because they would kill in the name of socialism and communism. And they killed, you know, a lot of people around the world in the name of communism. And fortunately, we've been spared that by the climate apocalyptic movement so far. Just believing in a thing doesn't mean you're right, and doesn't mean that you shouldn't listen to someone who is a bit more skeptical than you. I mean, in the process, the climate movement has essentially destroyed Western science. The way science is being conducted is now, it's, you know, only basically the majority has a right to publish and to, advise governments, and any skeptics have to shut up or have to be shut up. So the way science used to work in traditional Western societies, where it was clear that science needed checks and balances, just like governments need checks and balances, that doesn't exist anymore. There are no checks, there are no balances. And therefore, a lot of people are losing trust in the conventional way scientists now agitate and campaign, and don't trust them anymore.
Yeah, and this, when you talked at the beginning about how it's all falling apart, this is another way in which I think maybe it is falling apart that may, in some sense, be helpful, that climate science has ceased to be real science, that it is the zealots have seized control of the journals, of the promotion processes and so forth. They have succeeded, by and large, in preventing younger researchers from asking questions. And now they're finding that they're looking sillier and sillier. The models aren't working all that well. The policies aren't working all that well. And they have to somehow let in some air. But as Mikhail Gorbachev discovered about perestroika and glasnost, when you open up a system like that, it often doesn't survive the process. But I think a lot of younger researchers, too, must just be saying to themselves, this isn't why I became a scientist.
I don't see that the institutional science as it currently exists in the Western world, particularly at university level and with the scientific institutions, will be able to reform themselves. I think the radical reforms needed to safeguard science from its complete woke left-wing dominance. I mean, think about just how many so-called conservative scientists are left at Western universities. I mean, it's perhaps less than 10%. And they cannot afford to even voice their views or publish their papers because there would be a riot. The students are now at university. If they don't like their professors, they just shut down the course. They just, organize a riot. That's kind of normal nowadays at Western universities. So Western universities, I think, are facing an existential crisis of credibility. And the only way I can see this can be reformed and will have to be reformed is basically governments having to intervene and to institutionalize balance, institutionalize fairness. We have it in the courts, we have it in parliament, we need it at research and university level. We cannot have a kind of institution that is completely, utterly dominated just by one worldview and without any, second opinion. So that's why I think eventually these universities will have to, face a choice, either institutionalized balance, institutionalized fairness and openness, or shut down. And that's going to happen because without it, science will lose all credibility, I'm afraid, because people can, and we've seen it not just with the climate, we've seen it with nuclear energy, we've seen it with COVID. I mean, it could go on and on, the kind of ridiculous cancel culture at that level is self-destructive. And if governments want to safeguard science, they'll have to do something about it.
Yeah, which is a pretty grim thought. Actually, I admit it, I have a fantasy here in Canada in particular that the federal government will stop funding higher education, which is here is constitutionally a provincial responsibility, and the provinces will privatize the universities and say, you need to hire professors who can bring paying students into the classroom, willing to put up in fees and tuition and so on, the full cost of the salary you're paying the people who are teaching them. Because at the moment, I mean, you think it's bad in science, imagine the social studies, the former humanities. You could not get people, by and large, to pay anything like the full cost of their education. And it's interesting that you mentioned COVID, because I've noticed there's what might seem an illogical but fairly strong correlation between climate alarmists and support for drastic COVID measures versus climate skeptics who are also COVID skeptics. And in both cases, I think the establishment overplayed its hand. There was a Pyrrhic victory. They managed to silence debate on the usefulness of the vaccines, on the necessity of lockdowns, that kind of thing, completely in the first few years. And as a result, they got their way. And that was something of a disaster for them because it turned out so badly, including children losing those couple of critical years of socialization. Who ever heard of a vaccine? You have to take six of them and then you get the disease anyway. And they're so bad at rebuilding their credibility. The institutional crisis goes very deep in that regard.
Well, it's like science in the Soviet Union, where only one view was accepted. And critics, skeptics were suppressed. And the cost of it is that, you know, if you get it wrong, as they do habitually get it wrong, the public will lose trust in it. And so, I mean, privatization of university is obviously something that is still in the future. But I was talking about universities and research institutions that rely on taxpayers' funding. That's where government, you know, can tell them, look, you cannot continue with this woke ideology, with this one-sided kind of agenda where skeptical scientists are being canceled or sacked. And unless, as I said, you have to institutionalize. I mean, we have institutional justice system where if you are prosecuted for a crime, you have a lawyer or a barrister who can go to court and speak on your behalf. I mean, just imagine a government saying, well, we don't need that anymore. Why would we have a lawyer for someone who we think is a criminal? But at university level, that's totally acceptable. So that is one of the bad consequences of the climate hysteria, the destruction of Western scientific and academic institutions that do no longer allow skeptics to teach or to research or allow them any funding. And of course, we are now paying the price for not having thought this through, and look, what is interesting here in Britain is that now that the Conservatives are in opposition, they are suddenly very skeptical about net zero and these policies. And which is not surprising, because in opposition, you can suddenly start thinking. In government, you just basically drive an agenda you don't fully understand, and you're basically advised by the civil servants. But the Conservative Party leader now has for the first time set up a commission to look into the cost of net zero. Now, you would think that's a bit late after nearly 20 years of implementing these policies to actually have a look at the cost. But the point of this exercise is that she will now be actually inviting experts on the kind of conventional climate activist type of experts and more skeptical experts to provide this commission with an overall, a full kind of perspective of cost estimates. Now you think, why after 20 years are they beginning to look at the cost? Well, the reason is that costs are piling up. The economy is sinking fast. The deindustrialization, as you mentioned, is accelerating. There won't be much left of heavy industry in Britain. And the whole idea of turning everything into a kind of electric-powered economy is, again, something of a pipe dream if electricity prices go through the roof. So this need for really costing policies before you introduce them, that failed. And it's late in the day, but it might allow the Conservative Party to realize that this is just a bad idea and it has to be reconsidered in a more reasonable and in a more cost realistic or cost effective way.
And that's one of the odd things about the debate, in not just in Britain, certainly, though Boris Johnson was a huge letdown that way, but here in Canada and everywhere except arguably the United States, where Donald Trump is not apparently a believer in any aspect of the global warming scare, but how timid conservative politicians have been, particularly about saying, I'm not convinced by the science. They may say, I don't like this policy, we'll do it another way. But it's frankly bizarre how few of them have been willing to say, I do not believe that human beings are causing the weather to get worse, so I am not prepared to do massive harm to our economy in an attempt to make the weather better. It's true that the alarmists have tried to shut down debate, but a lot of people haven't pushed back as much as you'd hope they would have.
This has been a long debate between different kind of skeptics, whether it would be better to make the scientific argument that, you know, the science is unsettled and the warming that we've seen hasn't been that bad, or whether we should rather argue the kind of cost-benefit analysis. You know, does it actually make economic sense, the policies being introduced? We at the GWPF have from the start avoided to make the case that the science, there's a problem with the science, because the science, although it is not settled at all, as long as global temperatures keep rising, even though they are rising very moderately, very slowly, and perhaps only half of the speed that were originally predicted, but even though we decided that the most likely scenario for winning this battle would not be over the science, but would be over the economic cost of the policies. And it turned out that it is, at the end, the economic and public policy problems of the climate agenda that is bringing down the edifice, and the science will remain unsettled for decades to come, I'm pretty sure. The only argument so far on the science side of it is that, yes, we have seen global warming. The warming has been moderate and by and large not as negative as predicted. You know, the world is still better off today than it was 50 or 100 years ago, despite global warming. And some people might say because of global warming, because global warming has obviously brought a lot of benefits too. But it is mainly the political economic arguments that have won the day and are now forcing governments to back down and roll back. But you are right. What ministers or politicians should demand is an open scientific debate. And that has to be enforced by governments. It has to be institutionalized. They have to tell anyone who is funded by governments, that is taxpayers, that they have to accept science is about discussion. Science is about checking, shaking the tree, asking questions, being skeptical. And any institution that refuses to adopt this kind of open, balanced, fair, transparent way of doing science should be losing their funding, full stop.
And it's interesting because, you know, we've done a number of these webinars, including with a couple of people, Roger Pilkey Jr. being one and Judith Curry another, who actually think that there is some human-caused warming, and we'd be well advised to keep an eye on it, but that it's being drastically exaggerated, both the pace of it and the consequences, at least so far. So we don't have a party line here. We're actually having a discussion, including with people with whom I have some disagreement, because I mentioned, you know, I'm a historian. I'm a historian of ideas primarily. But when our prime minister went off on this subject, and I should actually back up a bit. I grew up at this cottage on Georgian Bay, which I mentioned in my documentary, 7 miles from the nearest road, no electricity, very, very rustic and a paradise. And I remember when I was a kid, my parents got involved in water sampling for pollution probe. So we were environmentalists from the very beginning, like before Earth Day, the first Earth Day. And I consider myself very committed to the environment from top to bottom. But also, because I'm a historian, when climate change became the big thing, my automatic thought was, what about the medieval warming period? And in fact, my grandfather was a medieval historian, so I know, you know, I grew up with that. And it seems fairly clear that temperature in the Holocene cycles, that it was warmer in 1150, 1200 AD than it is today, and that it cooled naturally and it's warming naturally. So I take the view that there is no clear signal of human impact on global temperature. But I also take the view that the weather in the Middle Ages was not conspicuously horrible. So this theory that if it gets a little bit warmer, we're going to have this dreadful, too much drought and too much rain. We're going to have wildfires everywhere, this and so forth. That this is one of the things that the alarmists, I mean, the physics is complicated enough, but there's much more straightforward science that we know about the relationship of temperature and weather and so on. And it doesn't support what they're saying. And so I think that even if you say that, well, we're not going to get way deep down into this issue of the incoming watts per square meter, but this whole idea that, say, it gets 1.5 degrees warmer than pre-industrial times, which is a phrase they used to mean 75 years after the Industrial Revolution, that we're going to get really, really bad weather. That is just a very unscientific assertion. There's no evidence in the past of geology of the planet that would make you think that was even possible.
Well, on the science, you know, I'm a skeptic. So I'm a skeptic on both sides. I'm a skeptic about people being very kind of dogmatic in one direction or dogmatic in the other direction. When it comes to medieval warm period or the you know, Holocene climate optimum or other warm periods or cold periods, the reality, as far as I understand it and from my reading, is that we haven't got a clue. We haven't got a clue. We don't know just how warm the medieval warm period was. We don't know whether it was global or hemispheric. We don't know how warm previous periods were, because the proxy data on which we rely are very uncertain in many respects. So that is part why I don't trust people saying this is unprecedented. The current warming is unprecedented. We haven't seen this in the last 10,000 years. We don't know. We don't know. You're absolutely right. There have been warm periods, cold periods during the Holocene. The only problem is we don't know just how warm or how cold these periods were. I mean, the climate alarmists are famous for claiming that a lot of civilizations collapsed because of cooling, because of cold phases. We don't know that for sure. Just as we don't know whether the medieval warm period was as warm as today or warmer than today. And your cat is just...
We're having an invasion of the animals. excuse me briefly one moment.
No, it's okay.
We love the wildlife and they're popular with the audience.
Anyway, the point I'm making is that we could, you know, discuss these scientific issues for hours and days to come, and we wouldn't solve them because of the uncertainties. But what is certain is that people have to pay, and pay a lot, for the policies, and that in itself turns them off much more so. And the interesting thing, the other interesting thing is that once people don't like the policies, they suddenly become climate skeptics because, oh, I don't like to pay for all of this. And I also think it's all crap, the whole climate issue. So there is a correlation between things you don't like and the position you take on climate science. But in reality, we don't know how much more warming we can expect. I agree that it's not a problem currently, but it could become a problem in the future for some countries, from some areas. However, my view is that we're very good at adaptation. And if you look at countries, you know, like the Gulf countries, like Saudi Arabia and others, or countries in the north, northern hemisphere, very up north, they can all deal with extreme temperatures, you know, and even very wealthy countries. So adaptation is always a possibility, even if we were to see more warming in coming decades. I have no doubt that we can deal with that.
Yeah, now, if we were going to get sidetracked, I'd mention that in the Middle Ages, French winemakers were actually appealing to the government for protection from the English wine industry, which leads me to conclude either it was a lot warmer then, or else the French had much worse taste then. But I would also say, see, we can sit here and discuss this and, you know, the extent to which there's uncertainty, how the proxies shouldn't be asked to do more than they can do. But on the other side, there's very little tolerance for that kind of thing. And for instance, people say to me, well, you know, what do you think is going to happen with the climate and so forth? My answer is, I don't know. I wish I did know. This is a very important question, but I cannot tell you whether we are going to see an acceleration in warming or a cooling trend. All sorts of things we think have happened in the past, including we certainly know there was a much more rapid warming at the end of the Younger Dryas cooling that happened right as we were coming out of the last glaciation. So we do need to be willing and ready to adapt. Again, you know, Canada, obviously, we are quite an agricultural power, but if it were a little warmer, we'd have more margin in our growing season, so it wouldn't be self-evidently a catastrophe. Saudi Arabia, in my opinion, is already too hot, but on the other hand, if you look at a distribution of human population around the globe, it's heavily concentrated in the tropics, so people don't seem to find heat to be a problem, even in poor countries, where obviously, oddly enough, cold still kills more people than heat in India, but nevertheless, obviously, heat can be an issue. But also the point you make about how when people start objecting to the cost of the policy, they stop believing in the science, which is not perhaps the best way of reasoning. But part of it is because the alarmists are telling us, look, it doesn't matter how much it costs, though we maybe weren't very frank about that. The cost of warming is going to be so great that no price is too high to pay to stop it. And in some sense, when people start saying, I'm not going to pay that much for it, what they're telling you is, I didn't really buy that argument.
No, absolutely. And it's not working anymore. This kind of, we have to do it no matter what. And one of the reasons why it's not working is because the rest of the world doesn't care about it. It's just the West that is deindustrializing and trying to decarbonize. The Chinese, the Indians, they burn whatever they can get hold of and are basically outcompeting us on the back of cheap energy. The West, you know, became wealthy on the back of cheap coal. And now, you know, other countries are doing the same thing, and rightly so. Why shouldn't they? You can't tell developing countries although the Europeans are actually telling developed, you know, I mean, the hypocrisy is amazing. The Europeans are telling African countries who are sitting on oil and gas fields, do not use that because of global warming, but sell it to us. We need it because of Putin. That's how the Europeans are dealing with the problem of developing countries sitting on their own oil and gas fields, is telling them, don't use them or we will punish you. They are punishing them. How are they punishing the poor countries? By putting up these kind of carbon border taxes, shutting, basically preventing developing countries from exporting their products at a competitive price. It is, you know, amoral, it is ridiculous, and it's no longer working. So I always knew that this would end in tears. I didn't know how long it would take, not least because I could see the parallel to the economic disaster of the Soviet Union and its kind of socialist allies. And this is going to end in tears just as much. Hopefully, it won't take three generations. It might only take two generations.
And there you raise another sort of pair of very odd things about the whole debate, because there was a big hoo-ha about 5 years ago about how Black Lives Matter. And yet when it comes to energy poverty in the third world and the appalling consequences that it has, especially in Africa, it's the place where proportionally the most people do not have anything like a reliable energy grid. They are pushing policies that will cause misery, illness, and death on a massive scale. And the other funny thing is that the European, I mean, most European governments are progressive. Most progressives are anti-imperialist. And yet here they are just assuming that if Europe says, hey, all you people in the third world, don't do this, we don't want you to, that they'll all just go, oh, okay, the wise European has spoken, the foolish local will obey. And that seems, it just seems a very strange thing for them to expect anybody to do.
Well, and the West have lost the kind of trust and credibility in much of the developing world. They are basically claiming that, we've caused global warming. But when the developing world then says, okay, you are blaming yourself for that, so we need a trillion in compensation. Well, then they say, well, we don't have that money, right? So this idea that Western governments have promised to transfer now, I think, 300 or 400 billion per year to the developing world, this is never going to materialize. That's clear. And of course, they will make so many enemies as a result. And of course, a lot of developing countries are aligning themselves with the Chinese or the Russians rather than with the West, because they can see the hypocrisy. The West is got wealthy and is still getting wealthy in some countries like the US, like Canada, some Australia, very energy wealthy, rich countries, who should be using their resources. But on the other hand, they're saying, oh, we are causing global warming, we will compensate you. It's a, it's a crazy, crazy self-destructive ideology that simply doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it takes away. Takes us back to what you were saying at the beginning. I was actually at COP29, and I remember a lot of people seemed astonished that these promises of $1 trillion or whatever they thought they were going to get weren't being kept. But again, these Western policymakers, it's a thing Thomas Sowell drew attention to in A Conflict of Visions about the different ways that those, the progressives versus the what he calls constrained visionaries, that progressives don't look at incentives and they don't look at precedents very much. So they go out and they make these promises in complete sincerity. When they go and tell the third world, yeah, you're going to get a huge amount of money, they really mean it, but they don't, in a sense, they don't understand what they just said. And then when it comes time to deliver, they have no idea how you'd go about it. Just as you look at their blithe assurance that they can build a domestic EV industry from scratch by throwing a few tens of billions of dollars at companies to build battery factories, which we're doing here. They don't understand the history of economic growth. They don't understand the nature of economics. They don't understand the science. They don't understand the history of geology. But you go on and on, the stuff they don't understand. Although I would say that anybody in the third world who thinks that cozying up to China or Russia is a winning plan, maybe they ought to look at their history a little more too. Because, I mean, again, we're creating a huge problem for everybody by being idiots, is what it comes down to.
Absolutely. Look, you call them progressives. I think that's the wrong name anyhow. We are talking with people primarily from the public sector nowadays, people, civil servants, people in institutions or think tanks, government-funded NGOs. That is mainly the group of people pushing this because it's in their self-interest. They don't care whether their policies will have negative consequences for the ordinary person in Europe or in Canada or in the US. They just see an opportunity for their institutions and for their kind of public sector funded jobs. Of course, all these policies are extremely detrimental to the living standards of ordinary people in Western countries, never mind the developing worlds. So this idea that they are progressives, I think this is an outdated term for people, self-serving kind of green lobbyists who are the only ones who are making money out of this. The vast majority of people, and they are beginning to realize, I mean, most of these parties have lost the working class anyhow. Working people are realizing that they have to pay for all these crazy policies. And they are, of course, now increasingly turning against these governments. And that's why I think there is no way out of this for left-wing parties or left-wing governments. As long as they stick to these policies, there is no hope for them. And even now here in Britain, with a relatively new Labour government, they can sense that is no longer sustainable. This whole policy is no longer sustainable. And if they stick to it, they will be kicked out sooner rather than later and won't survive. You can see this all over Europe. These parties are becoming smaller and smaller, marginal, and being kicked out of government all over Europe. So that's the price that the socialists had to pay, and that's the price the eco-socialists will have to pay.
Yeah, I mean, they've certainly got themselves into a trap, partly, as you say, this huge state and parastatal apparatus where the people inside it have a strong material incentive in keeping the thing going. Although I do, again, think when you look at these people, that their view is that if they are well rewarded for bestowing the benefits of their superior understanding upon the peasantry, that's just the universe unfolding as it should. That they don't think that their policies are going to hurt ordinary people. They think ordinary people are a basket of deplorables who don't know what's good for them. But at the same time, as you say, electorally, it's starting to look shakier and shakier. I mean, the last British election, obviously, Reform did very well in the popular vote, but not so well in the seat count. But if its growth continues, it will have a huge breakthrough, and one of the traditional parties will simply go extinct that you thought could never ever be dislodged from the political landscape, because they're trapped. They're trapped intellectually and they're trapped institutionally by the incentives. And again, people sometimes look at Donald Trump and suggest that he is not very well-mannered or well-informed. But it doesn't seem that anybody else was able, even in the United States, to break the logjam. And that's a bad thing, because if the parties cannot recognize that something has gone wrong and adjust, then you're going to get an upheaval. And in a, it would be much better if they would open the windows, open the doors, open their minds, and have a discussion about how much of what we said seems to have been borne out by the course of events, and how much of what we said, including about how this policy would work in practice, has turned out to be wrong, and where should we back off? Because again, Keir Starmer, who is, you know, no giant, let's be fair to the man, doesn't seem to have much capacity to rethink things.
Well, we'll have to wait and see, because if you can't get rid of Ed Miliband and the net zero kind of obsession, Labour has no future. It has no future. They will be kicked out in the local elections and in by-elections. And the same is true for any country and any party that closes its eyes about the, you know, irrational and unsustainable way of net zero and these and green policies. Whether the parties will get back to the kind of mainstream, let's talk this through and let's have a proper discussion about the pros and the cons and let's cost this, I hope so. I hope we will get back to that, because that's what Western civilization used to be. But we have moved in a very dangerous way for numerous reasons into an increasingly authoritarian kind of censorship, suppression of other views type of culture, which can only end badly. So how to get back to normal forms of gentlemanly kind of conduct where you agree to disagree, I don't know. But if we don't get back to that, it's going to be really, really poisonous. You know, Trump is a symptom of this. He's not the cause of it, but the result of this kind of policy that was adopted about 20 years ago, the demonization of opposition. And of course, both can play this, you know, both sides of a polarized culture can play this kind of dangerous demonization game. And we have to think how to get back to, as I said, more gentlemanly norms. Will be difficult, but having proper institutions that allow both sides to be represented and accept that there are different views and accept that it's necessary for any democracy to have these views, not just accepted, but as a matter of principle, that's where we have to get back to. And currently, it doesn't look like it.
Yeah, but I just have to underline, you're saying Trump is a symptom that is so important, that Trump is not the kind of person who could have or did cause this. He is a response to conditions. And again, you look at the British Labour Party, but also Canada's Liberals and any number of other, the Democrats in the United States and so on. It's not just climate, you know, on gender, on multiculturalism, on all manner of issues. They've adopted this exceptionally unhelpful approach, the silencing of dissent, the smearing of dissenters, the heavy-handed use of state power, and as you say, in ways that are ultimately counterproductive. So it's in their interest, too, to find a way not to provoke this kind of reaction. Actually, a colleague of mine at the National Post has just written a book, Don't Be Canada, about how one country could have gotten everything so wrong. So there's been a really across-the-board disaster in policy because of this disaster in way of thinking. And of course, there are yahoos on every side. But I think in some sense, if I can't call them progressives, I'll call them the left. They're so convinced they're the good guys that they have a lot of trouble scrutinizing their own behavior. And the conservatives on the whole have been rolling over, and maybe they need to learn to stand up. But again, civilly, with a view that there are actually that a person who has a functioning brain and a functioning heart could hear my opinion and still not share it. Because that's an idea that more and more people seem to find just baffling. And by the way, we're almost out of time here. Now, you're stepping down from as director of the Global Warming Policy Foundation. So what's next for you? Do you have new projects you'd like to tell people about?
I'm writing, basically, and go a little bit more deeper into the problems we face, not just on the climate, but on the whole kind of the roots of catastrophic thinking, basically trying to understand why it's so attractive for people to become alarmists and catastrophists rather than taking a more balanced view of evidence. That's what I'm writing about. That's at least will take me for the next couple of years to write that book.
Well, excellent. That's my kind of thing. My doctoral dissertation is actually on Richard Nixon's diplomacy, but it was about ideas. It was about the way in which the debate over detente and realpolitik and so on there was too little meeting of the minds. Not because I expected everybody to agree, but there was far too little awareness of the kind of structure of the disagreement, the ways in which other people were thinking differently than oneself. And I know somebody here in Ottawa who has written a number of books about the JFK conspiracy theories and why they're wrong. And I keep urging him to write a book on why people like conspiracy theories generally. So I think that this idea of why people are prone to panics, because I sometimes feel like as soon as we get rid of this one, something else will come along and it might be worse. It would be hard to imagine how, but humans are inventive when AI. It comes to disaster.
AI.
So is it going to be the problem or is it going to be the solution?
It will kill the planet in 10 years.
Okay, good. I fear it.
10 years to save the world from AI.
Somebody was saying about talking, do you use AI in your work? And I said, I'm John Connor. I want to teach mankind to fight back against the machines while we still can.
You see, you've already been
you use AI to turn a few points into a long email, and then someone on the other end uses AI to turn the long email into a few points. And right. It's like, why don't you just say what you think? Let's stand up for humanity here.
Right.
And hold back the rising tide of panic. Not that we shouldn't be concerned about things. There's a lot of things I worry about. In some sense, I suppose I have a bit of an alarmist bent. I'm thinking, well, here comes China. This is terrible. Here comes AI. This is terrible. The family's falling apart. We've got its idiot trade war and everybody's a skinhead. So there's a lot to worry about. But let's not make ourselves part of the problem. We always try that at the Climate Discussion Nexus, by the way. We don't allow obscenities in our social media comments. And some people think that's very odd, but I'm thinking to myself, we got to take a stand somewhere. How about, not using rude words while debating climate? There must be another way.
That's a good start.
Yeah, so there you have a call for civility, open-mindedness across the board. I think it was Chesterton said to disagree without being disagreeable. And so we encourage everybody to get into the debate and by all means have a vigorous point of view, even if it's not my point of view, you're allowed to, on the extent to which we do or don't know what happened in the past or the extent to which humans are or not contributing, all these kinds of things. But let's be the debate we want to hear. If we want the politicians to open the windows and let the fresh air in, let's make sure that we open the windows and let the fresh air in. Let's all try to make this a debate that is edifying and constructive. And in that regard, again, Benny, I want to thank you so much for being on the program, for sharing your insights, your perspective on a long and valiant battle against idiotic ideas.
Thanks, John, and good luck in Canada. Fingers crossed.
As they say in Toy Story, you're going to need it. And thanks to everybody for watching, either live or in the recorded version. You know, be sure to check out the Global Warming Policy Foundation, support their work. Also, please do support the Climate Discussion Nexus, because we don't get any government money. We are dependent on you. You're our sponsors. And tune in for our next webinar. Whatever time of day it is, good morning, good evening, good afternoon, and thank you for being with us.